Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. How's your garden looking? Is it time to start transitioning to fall? Help you out today, Mark Dwyer back with us. He's Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. So we'll be taking a look at late season gardening, talk with Mark about the theme gardens they have at Rotary, and of course, answer your gardening questions. So I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can find us at the Ideas Network Facebook page, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Mark Dwyer, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. Good to be here.
You know, I saw on your Facebook page some wonderful photos of the memory garden that you have at Janesville Rotary Garden. But before we get to that, just talk in general about the Rotary Garden for those who aren't familiar with it.
Sure, absolutely. So Rotary Botanical Gardens is located in Janesville, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. We're 20 acres. This is our 29th year. We're on the site of an old sand and gravel pit, and what happened back in the late 80s and early 90s was reclamation of this site, which has become an internationally themed garden featuring over 4,000 types of plants spread over 26 different garden themes. Lots of volunteers. Our mission is education, so lots of great programs, and we'd love to have people come visit.
And right off the interstate, I've been there many a time, and it's just a quick drive right off the interstate.
Literally, right off of I-90. We're 5 minutes off the highway there.
So the memory garden, I saw your photos on the memory garden that you have. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, our newest garden area, and keeping in mind as a nonprofit, our intent is to maintain what we have, but we had some wonderful donations for what we're calling our new wellness garden. And this garden is developed in the site of our old arboretum and was just dedicated about a month ago. And what it includes is a wide range of sensory-type plants, fragrance, tactile, certainly beauty. But the garden is designed for all accessibility with nice paved paths. Everyone can, all our visitors can enjoy the space. But there's some specific raised beds for those with mobility impairments.
Yeah.
And the intent of the garden itself is it develops further, because I feel this is phase one of a couple phases as it materializes and includes more features, is to offer a programming opportunity to address a demographic of visitors where we can have them actively participate in activities and programs out in that space and immerse them immediately. And it's at peak color right now. It's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. And here I called it a memory garden. I'm sorry. It was
a
wellness
fine.
Garden is really what it is, and it looks just beautiful. And you have an international aspect as well, as you were talking about in the beginning here, to the gardens as well.
Right, with those 26 garden themes. And when you think about the term Rotary Gardens, we were founded by a Rotarian, and Rotary clubs are worldwide. And the intent when the gardens was founded 29 years ago was to demonstrate a lot of different garden styles and plants from around the world. So, Larry, you mentioned garden themes. We have a Japanese garden, English cottage style, a French formal garden. And this wellness garden now becomes our 26th distinct garden theme or garden room that's peppered throughout this 20 acres.
It's really, really a cool place to visit. And, of course, now, is while some gardens are looking a little perhaps not so good, the Rotary Garden looks wonderful.
Well, we really strive to make sure we have something of interest throughout the year, and that includes our winter months where we have a massive light show to keep people coming through. But this time of year, we had a very cool and wet start to spring, so everything was a little delayed for us. So in terms of peak summer color, and we do a lot of annuals. There's 125,000 annuals out there, also throughout the wellness garden. So peak color right now has extended very nicely into August. So it's a great month to come visit, and certainly get on our website and see what sort of other activities might be happening at the gardens or in town.
Get some good ideas for your own garden as you visit that, then, as for listeners.
And that's why we're there. Education, lots of plant labels, and again, opportunities.
Well, let's take some calls. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Dot in Chippewa Falls, thanks a lot for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have a question for you. I have a bunch of phlox in my garden, and I would like to know the proper way to deadhead them so you get more blooms.
All right. Good question.
Yeah, great question. This time of year, garden phlox are blooming very strongly. And I should clarify, with perennial phlox, there are early season phlox, woodland phlox. There's a lot of phlox that have already finished blooming. But the taller garden phlox start hitting stride in July into August. And to Dot's point, they start looking a little tired out, the primary flowers. And in terms of deadheading, that's the process of removing spent blooms to tell the plant, hey, why don't you make some new flowers? We're not going to let you go to seed. So the best way to deadhead those taller garden phlox is to take that main flower stem down to the second or third set of leaves below the flower itself. You can even take it further, because what you're going to see are some little lateral branchlets coming off the main stem. There might be some smaller flowers already blooming off of that, but be fairly aggressive about taking that main flower off. And what will happen is it'll encourage new blooms, and those secondary blooms that are just starting will fill out nicely. So not a lot of people always have time for the deadheading, but what it does is prolong the bloom period of this type of perennial and many others.
Yeah, and that's what we're talking about right now. Good luck, Dot. Thank you very much for calling. Jeff in Door County, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. Great show. I've got a question about pumpkins. I started them from seed in February in a greenhouse, and I have them outside now, and they're just getting absolutely massive. I've never grown pumpkins before, and okay. I'm wondering how you feed them. Do you feed them from the base, or do you feed, I mean, as far as fertilizer, or the spikes that go in off those shoots that come out? How do I feed these plants?
Well, fertilizing pumpkins, keep in mind there's a danger in over-fertilizing.
Yes. You
certainly want, and it sounds like your pumpkins are doing great, Jeff, which is nice to hear. Heavy nitrogen-based fertilizer, a big concern would be you'd get a lot of more foliar growth at the expense of additional fruiting. But to your question about the fertilization, anywhere you have any sort of active root growth is where you'd want to apply it, whether that's at the base or if you're getting some additional rooting along those stems. The plant will disperse it. But I'd be wary of later season fertilization simply, again, because of encouraging it to have more foliar growth at a time of year when it should be putting more energy into those fruits.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Christine in Milwaukee. Hi, Christine.
Hey, hi.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Thanks for having me. Here's my thought. I have lots of pots of flowers, petunias, and, you know, the typical flower pot stuff. They're looking horrible. They're leggy. They're not blooming. And I drive by a lot of other people's homes at their pots. They look great. And I'm like, no, I don't want to do mums yet. I know the mums are out in all the big box stores, but to me a mum is like October-type flower. So what do I do from now for the next month or so to make these flower pots still look good?
Well, great question. Now, one thing to consider is if the legginess is, it may be simply the plants are getting a little tired and need some rejuvenation, which I'll mention in just a second, but a concern in a container, leggy flowers may be indicative of not being in enough light. They might be stretching out for additional light. Assuming these are in full sun, which they would require, I would just make sure also that your soil in those containers is well drained. So it's not an issue of having a lot of moisture where plants are actually struggling simply because of not having well-drained soil. Assuming those two things are taken care of, petunias in particular, you can cut them back severely and follow up immediately with some sort of a liquid fertilizer or some sort of a boost. And what's happened essentially to the majority of our annuals at Rotary Gardens, petunias included, is they've already been sheared back or cut back twice and followed with this fertilizer regimen, because by cutting them back, we're creating additional growing buds are encouraged to create new stems and flowers, and we get a bushiness that's encouraged by that fertilization. So you have to pamper them, and that's why maybe you're seeing some that are thriving. Just a little more pampering and you'll be good to go.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Christine, good luck with your plants. Let's go to William in Milwaukee. Hi, William.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
Well, as of late, I've been having some problems with ground ivy. I think it's creeping Charlie. I could be wrong, but I mean, this stuff grows back every year despite my best interest, and now it's kind of making its assault on my potato garden. And I'm trying to wonder, is there anything I can really do to keep it away from my plants and ideally get to the root of it? Since, for the life of me, I've tried a lot of different things to get rid of it.
Well, and I know, Larry, I know this question's come up a couple times on the show, and There are some people that are proposing certain chemical treatments, which I'm not up to date with, and I'm a little wary of, simply because I'm not convinced that you'll get 100% of the plant, and it may be at the expense of some other ones as well. Creeping Charlie is very difficult to remove selectively, meaning not if it's growing through turf or other areas, not harming additional plants if you're trying to get rid of it, meaning leaning on an herbicide application or repeated applications to remove it, which becomes dangerous if you're near food crops. You don't want to use a lot of chemicals, is my guess. We have an issue at home. My wife and I, what we've done in an area with Creeping Charlie is put some black plastic over it and are really essentially trying to cook it out of there. We're getting a lot of, we're excluding rainwater. We're getting a lot of heat under that. And it'll be weeks and weeks before we see a decline. And even after that, we're concerned about it popping back. And incidentally, the heat generated by that plastic also damages a lot of beneficial organisms in the soil as well. But Larry?
Well, all I was just going to say is that if your neighbors have it, it's going to be just a kind of a constant battle to keep it out. Now, we in my lawn area, my daughter and I will go out and spend an hour just pulling it in the spring, and that doesn't get all of it, but what it does do is help the lawn, for example, to beat it back, and the lawn then starts to win over the Creeping Charlie. And you'd be surprised how much you can pull, even in a garden, in a half hour. You can pull a lot of that Creeping Charlie and give the other plants sort of a head start on it or a way to beat it back. But I don't think if you've got it around you and the neighbors, I don't think you're ever going to keep it out entirely. You have to keep your other plants growing vigorously and well, and so they can outcompete the Creeping Charlie. That's the best we can do on that, William. I appreciate your call very much. And frankly, in the spring, they're the first thing to flower. And so a lot of our insects that rely on nectar and so forth get some use from the Creeping Charlie because it's the first thing to flower.
Mm-hmm. I've about a third of my lawn is still Creeping Charlie, and I've left it. But to your point about vigor, yeah, the concern is the balance of healthy turf versus Creeping Charlie and violets and other things that might be occurring.
Yeah, there you go. You can join in too, by the way. We're taking a look at flowers and the garden today with our guest, Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we'll take a look at some of those emails. Dave, maybe you can put up some of those. But let's take a call, too, at the same time. Vicki in Janesville, it's your turn. Hi, Vicki.
Yes, thank you. Good morning. I have a multitude of coneflowers, and they are starting to, you know, wane. They're getting dried. Is there a way that I can deadhead the coneflower and more will bloom?
Well, you certainly can deadhead, Vicki. The issue with purple coneflower, some folks will actually leave them, let them go to seed because they're great for wildlife. And I know visually sometimes that is not appealing for others. But the whole concept of, again, of removing spent blooms and encouraging additional ones, it will occur with purple coneflowers. It's a whole lot of deadheading. And there is a point in time where they're just simply going to stop blooming as we get a little further into September. But the short answer is, yes, you can do that.
All right. And so where would she break them off?
Similar to what we mentioned with the phlox, you'd want to take what you'll notice with purple coneflowers. There's a long piece of stem beneath that flower, typically down to the first set of leaves. Go below that. Go further down into the plant. In fact, if there's no additional stalks with viable flowers or interesting flowers, I'd take that entire stalk all the way down to the bottom set of leaves.
All right. There we go. On to Connie in Appleton next. Hi, Connie.
Hello. I was looking for help on what to do with eradicating some thistles that have popped up in our landscaping.
Oh, boy. Do you know the type of thistle you have? Is it a Canada thistle?
I don't know the type. It has a purplish flower on the top.
Okay.
And it's about 2 feet tall.
Oh.
And there's about a dozen of them that are scattered in the landscaping.
Well, it's good that there's only a dozen, because I've had people call and have had thousands and thousands. So a dozen, I think you can handle. And I'll tell you, at Rotary Gardens, we are not chemical-free, so there are times when we may use an herbicide. But a situation like that with thistles, what we've done is we wait for a nice heavy rain, a good soaker, and we'll go out there with gloves. And if you grab hold of that thistle and pull straight up, hopefully you'll get the root. And I don't know what your soil's like, but you really need to get the root, because they're very similar to dandelions in that they'll snap off a portion of the root and regenerate. So you want to pull up pretty much what looks like a white carrot with a long root. And if there's still pieces down there, you certainly could dig those out. But you have to keep on top of it. And keep in mind, there's probably additional thistle seed that's migrated into that area. So you'll probably have additional plants late this year or early next year that you'll have to keep on top of. But I think your problem at this point in time is certainly manageable with manual control.
And, you know, then you're getting rid of them and the seed source is going away as well. And so over time, you know, you can get rid of them. But it takes a little bit of work, that's for sure. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Bob in Medford up next.
Hey, Medford, you got me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I'm a former county extension agent and also an ag teacher and a homeowner. And with ground, you know, with the creeping Charlie or ground ivy, about the only thing you can do, because you're going to want to take care of dandelions and other things in your yard anyway, is go ahead and use a herbicide. It's going to take two applications of 2,4-D or an application of Trimec. And if you stay on it, and like you say, you know, fertilize your yard, make sure it's healthy, don't cut it too short, things like that, you'll get rewards from it.
Right.
As far as buy a garden, the only thing you probably do is use a swab or something, and, you know, like they used to use with before Roundup Ready corn and all this here stuff, and volunteer corn, they used to have rope wicks with Roundup on it.
Yep.
And just swab it a little bit with Roundup to take care of the stuff that's coming your way, because that'll go back through the chain of command and the root system and take care of some of it.
All right. Bob, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Talking today with Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your garden today, flowers and shrubs, with our guest, Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens. Larry Mueller here. And again, you can join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Or go to our Facebook page and post there as well. What are some plants that homeowners can consider adding to their gardens right now as we go into the, you know, getting closer to the fall season?
Well, there's, you know, it's still, there's recommendations typically not to plant during the heat of summer with certain types of plants, but I feel proper installation and watering, it's not a bad time to consider adding perennials later in the season. And as ground temperatures continue to be warm over the next couple of months, root establishment is excellent. So what I'm rambling on to say is it is a great time to consider some additional plants. And ideally, you consider voids in color. You know, if you've had a strong spring in terms of coloration, maybe your annuals are waning a little bit. There's so many great perennials that take over the show. The wide range of ornamental grasses that offer texture and movement in the landscape. We're heading into the time of year where asters are starting to bloom.
Yeah.
So a lot of the later composites. As our daylilies finish and some of our midsummer bloomers, things like Helen's flower, Russian sage, there's just some great plants that will continue to be colorful for a wide period of the summer.
Yeah, lots there. Pam in Kellogg, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I think it's wild indigo that is about 3 feet tall, and it has like a pea pod on it and little seeds in it. Well, I wanted to have some of those and started the seeds, and they're only about less than 2 inches tall now. So I know they aren't established enough to make it through the winter. Is there any hope that I can do something so I don't have to start over again next spring?
Well, absolutely. I think the thing you should know about your baby indigos there is that they'll still need to go through a winter. That doesn't mean you have to leave them out in the snow in you know, negative 10 degrees or anything like that, but you'd have to simulate some sort of a winter, whether it's in the garage, an unheated garage, or a location where they're allowed to go dormant and but still experience those cold winter months. And then they should be fine. You certainly can perpetuate those over the winter months.
All right, there we go. Thank you for calling. Roger in Little Chute, your turn. Hi, Roger.
Good morning. Because of the change we're making in our house, I have to move a flower bed. And in that flower bed are ferns, hostas, astilbes, da-da-da-da. And I have a place to put them and so on. Is it too early to divide and transplant some of that?
Actually, not at all. And, you know, it's... I think we all know it's not the ideal time, but your circumstances dictate this is the time for you. And just understand that movement of these plants will be certain stresses, and that establishment with adequate watering and such is so important. Those plants will look a little tough for the rest of the season, but they should recover very nicely. If there's any way you can time the division or the digging and the movement, try to pick a cool overcast day. Do it as quickly as possible. Get everything in. Water real well, and you'll have a great success rate. I really think it's entirely possible, and just be, you know, very concise about doing it.
All right. There you go, Roger. Thank you for calling. And let's go to Lyle in Cedarburg next. Hi, Lyle.
Good morning, and a great show. I have a question on wood violet. I have a number of mulched areas where I put hemlock either around trees or simply to grow wildflowers. And in a couple of the areas, the violet kind of took over, but it seems to be, you know, fairly attractive. And I wondered what the conventional wisdom is, let it grow or get rid of it.
Well, on a personal note, I'm a huge fan of violets. And I think we all know they can spread very quickly. And the reason they're doing so well there is they can take very tough soils. And if you consider a droughty lawn, you know, as we've seen people's lawns brown out, the last thing that stays green out in those lawns are violets. And they have great mechanisms for drought tolerance, et cetera. So my personal opinion is encouraging them as a ground cover is a good idea. However, they may run amok after that. They don't know any constraints in terms of movement. So you'd have to kind of regulate where you want them and where you don't. But they're a beautiful plant, great for pollinators. And if it's working for you, I would go for it.
I would. And if, you know, for those who want to get rid of wood violets, they're extremely difficult to actually eliminate. If they've got the right conditions, they're going to thrive.
Right.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Lyle, for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Keith called to say he gets rid of thistles by cutting them down close to the ground, and he sprinkles a little salt around them. Also, a caller would like to know if she can put thistles in the compost heap, or should she put them in black plastic?
Well, the thing with thistles, if they're already blooming and starting to go to seed, there's a real I would not put them in the compost pile. But if it's just the stems and leaves, you certainly can. And if you're maintaining a compost pile at the appropriate heat and also doing all the turning and such, it's fine. If you do have any concerns though about adding anything to your compost pile, simply don't.
Kenneth asks for clarification on the indigo question. Does she keep it in the ground over winter, or does she dig it up?
Great question. I guess when she called, I had assumed it was that they were already in pots.
Yeah, so that's what I did too.
In that case, I would keep them in the garage. The concern with their rooting, if that rooting depth is now limited by pots, if that's the situation, so I would be concerned leaving them out. Those pots would end up being frozen like ice cubes. So, but if they're in the ground right now, you could some light mulching and such and keep them protected. They would still be okay in my mind. We have Baptisia seedlings all over the gardens that overwinter at heights of 1 to 2 inches, but they've rooted very deeply already into the soil, surrounding soil.
Thanks again for that call. Our guest today, Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. Questions for him, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Did you have You know, you have a lot of pretty good rain this year in your neck of the woods. Were there any disease issues that you noticed that created problems for you?
Well, we're starting to see quite a bit of mildew, and not unusual, powdery mildew and some others. So the earlier caller about garden flocks, we're starting to see some mildew on some of the standard plants. You would notice it on the foliage, things like lilacs, garden flocks, and some other things. But it's not a huge concern at this point. And I actually have to admit, I'm a little surprised with all the rain we've had. And I say consistent moisture, which has been great for the garden. But we've had a lot of cooler than usual days and you know, it has never really quite dried out. So I'm surprised we haven't seen more.
Let's go to Vicki in Green Lake. Vicki, hello.
Hi. Hey, I just have a question. I had, I let my perennial bed go last year, and I've been weeding it for the last 2 months. Have it pretty much cleared out. Is it a good idea to fertilize now before I remulch it, or wait till springtime to fertilize it?
Well, my feeling on fertilizing perennials, I'll let you know what we do at Rotary Gardens, and that's we fertilize all our perennials twice a year. We do it in June, and then we do it in September. Having said that, is it essential to even fertilize perennials if you have decent soil? Not necessarily, but if your interest is in giving them a boost, if you're going to do it later this year, wait for about a month, month and a half. Do it as you get into mid to later September, because that fertilizer will be used for establishing roots prior to winter. The danger with doing it now is you encourage lush growth at a time of year when plants are going to start thinking about getting ready for the tail end of the season. So otherwise, just wait till spring and you're good to go.
I usually wait. I do it in spring.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And with my perennials, and that seems to work really, really well. So, Vicki, thank you for calling. Just wait a little bit before you put that fertilizer down. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Do you have some events coming up, by the way? I haven't talked about that. I know you just had an event.
Right. We just had a great horticultural therapy symposium yesterday utilizing that new wellness garden. We do have some events. On our website, of course, is our lecture series and some other fun educational opportunities. But in September, we have our big fall plant sale, and that's September 7th, 8th, and 9th. There'll be information on our website very shortly. And as we head into the tail end of the season, that big light show I alluded to earlier starts on Black Friday this year. And last year we saw 46,000 people go through this thing, so we'd love to have more. And it pays the bills and my fat cat salary, so come on down, folks.
Let's go to Sue in Soldiers Grove next. Hi, Sue. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering what flowering plants would do well in the shade that are deer resistant.
Well, great question. Some of the issues we're seeing at Rotary Gardens this year is heavy deer browsing on a lot of things, including a lot of annuals and many perennials. So the challenge is, number one, you have deer. Number two, shade can be limiting because of root competition and other issues. Some great plants for shade. Now, keep in mind, as you get into more shade, these plants all flower, but you're limited with flower appeal, meaning you do become a little more reliant on foliage. So what I recommend to folks is things like lungwort, also called pulmonaria. Beautiful spring flowers, but very sandpapery type leaves that the deer don't like to nibble on. False forget-me-nots, the Latin name for that is brunnera. Those are also, again, very rough leaves. Plants like hellebores, there's a wide range of shade-tolerant plants. A great category for shade tolerance, drought tolerance, and deer resistance are epimediums. And I think everyone should look into these plants because they thrive for us. They're spring bloomers, but beautiful foliage that's untouched by browsing and also gets a little fall color to it. So again, the brunneras, mentioned brunneras, pulmonarias, epimediums, and hellebores is a great start.
Sue, I hope that helps out.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Let's turn to Dusty in Baldwin. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate your call.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad I was able to call in. I have last fall, I took mountain ash berries, and I was able to separate the seeds from them, and I finally got one to germinate this spring. And now it's about 3 or 4 inches tall. I keep it in a pot in the house, set it out in the sun in the nice days. And I'm wondering what I should do with it this winter, let it go dormant in a garage or try and keep it alive in the house.
Great question, and it's not too dissimilar to our Baptisia or Indigo question earlier, and that's that your mountain ash would have to experience winter dormancy. So you'd have to, if you can create that in your garage, 35 degrees or lower, being that small, I'd be wary of putting it out unless maybe you put it along a foundation and screened it from animals or critters, but do provide its winter dormancy. Don't keep it in as a house plant.
All right, there we go. Thank you, Dusty. Louise in Ridgeland, Wisconsin, thank you for calling.
Yes, I was wondering, thank you for taking my call, and I was wondering if you have a suggestion for the molds in my yard. I have ridges getting all over.
Yeah, and usually a lot of ridges sometimes only means one or two moles. They can make a lot of damage.
Yeah, that's a tough question. We haven't had that issue, and of course we're at the gardens we're trying to encourage wildlife, but in that case, that's a negative impact on your landscape, of course. And I think that's where local extension agents and giving a call out to say, get some advice on what others have done, may be the best approach.
Yeah, there are some products out there that you can use. MoleMed is one. There are different products out there, but they all have, some success, but not a ton of success. We've used a situation where you can put a dig a little hole in one of the runways that's being used by the moles, and you can put a box over the top of that part, and you can put a trap in there bait it with some bacon, put it inside, and then inside the box, and then have that hole open a little bit. And sometimes you can get them to come in, and they'll smell the bacon and come up, and you can trap them and get rid of them that way. And then the neighbor's cat's not going to get it either, mm-hmm. because it's covered with a box. That's one. I know one of our listeners has had great success with that approach. So something to think about anyway, Louise. Let's take another call. By the way, open lines at 800-642-1234. Give a call. Ellen in Spooner, your turn. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I have a question. I have a sedum that it spreads all over the place. And I'm wondering how I can get rid of that.
Hmm.
Yeah, I'm assuming it's a ground cover type sedum. A lot of these creeping sedums as ground covers literally also know no bounds. They'll continue to go. And, again, with hand removal, you have to get every little piece and as much of the roots as possible. So manual control is possible. Using herbicides is also an opportunity. The challenge is if this creeping sedum has worked its way around other desirable plants, if you're trying to manually remove or spray everything in between, you'll never get rid of it, meaning little chunks will be around your good plants. So something we've done with aggressive ground covers, if we have good things in the midst, we'll dig those out. We'll actually rinse off the roots and make sure every speck of any additional plant is off those. And then we'll treat what's left, meaning in your case, the sedums, with an herbicide. And then later on, weeks later, re-prepare the bed and then insert those plants back in or in another location. If you do herbicidal control, you'll want to probably do it more than once. Don't assume you've taken care of the problem, because creeping sedums, we don't plant creeping sedums anymore at Rotary Gardens because of what you just described, unfortunately.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Ellen. And good luck with your sedums. Appreciate it very much. Kryn in Dubuque, Iowa, up next. Hi, Kryn.
Hi.
What's on your mind today?
I was wondering if you could help me. I try to bring in rosemary every year, and I seem to kill it every year. I've tried cool, I've tried warm, I've tried not watering too much, watering too little. I didn't know if there was any way to
keep it over the year and or over the winter and then plant it again next summer.
Okay, what do you think?
It's a real challenge. You know, if you've got a garden center that stays open through the winter, maybe see if you could pay them to babysit it for you because they might have the right situation. It sounds like you've tried a lot of ways of doing it because most often the failure with overwintering rosemary is not adequate winter lighting and overwatering.
Yeah.
So they do have to be kept dry. You don't want the home too humid. There's humidity issues. They're extremely challenging, and sometimes it seems to be no rhyme or reason on their success or demise. So they're extremely challenging, and that's why maybe there's a situation where you could get some help overwintering it.
Yeah. Grow lights, do they work for rosemary?
Absolutely. And when you think about bringing those plants in their native Mediterranean climates at like full, you know, blazing sun, our winter lighting is such a fraction of what they need. They'll start to struggle, and then if too much water is part of that equation, it's a death sentence.
Good luck, Corinne. Thank you. Doug and Trevor, it's your turn. Hi, Doug.
Yeah, hey. I wondered what kind of vegetables by seed could I be successful with now, like with carrots or beets or lettuce? What could I be successful? I'm in southeast Wisconsin.
Yeah, Doug, your timing's still great for everything you just mentioned. Any of the greens, any of the lettuces, certainly. You mentioned beets, radishes. There's a wide range of things that'll germinate very quickly. And, you know, when you look at the seed packet on the days to being able to cultivate or utilize those plants, there's still a wide range of things that'll fit into that 35 to 45 days after germination before we start heading into winter. So many of the garden centers are still carrying seeds of those types of plants for this purpose, a mid-season sowing, so you can get some goodies before it gets too cold.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck with that, Doug. Thank you. And we'll take some more calls in just a minute. A reminder that Mark Dwyer is our guest today, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at your garden as we near the fall season start. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. Questions for him, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jim in Madison, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. My neighbor successfully planted some milkweed plants, and I'm wondering if you could describe how I could use the seeds from the pods and plant some myself. Would I need to plant them in pots and then subject them to cold temperatures and then transplant them in the spring? Or what should I do if I want to try that?
Do you know what type of milkweed he has, by the way? Is it just the common milkweed or...
Boy, I sure don't.
Okay.
You know, it looked like what I always remember as a kid when I used to see a lot of wild milkweed. Has a, you know, a flower, a bright flower in the midsummer, and then now the pods are present in the plant.
Yeah.
You know, Jim, with your approach, you're mentioning containers, you certainly can do that. You can, once those pods split and you start to see the white feathery attachments to the seeds, you certainly could sow them in containers. And the winter treatment's essential. The only concern is after germination, you'd want to plant them as fairly young plants because they established quite a rooting system. And some people will take the seeds and actually sow them, wet them down, put them under a thin layer of soil, and next spring you'll see some germination in all likelihood, unless they've moved around or been disturbed. But again, it's remarkable to me that how adaptable milkweed is, and I understand the importance of it, but sometimes challenging to grow. So again, that sowing into containers, you would want to, as soon as you get some germination and some active growth, get those out in the locations you'd like to keep them.
And remember that if you put them in with other flowers, sometimes milkweed will, some forms of milkweed, especially the common one, will extrude something from its root system that will inhibit other plants. And you kind of need to be aware of that as well,
mm-hmm.
For sure. Let's go to Donna in Milwaukee. It's your turn. Hi, Donna.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mine is about milkweed, and there's flies on there all the time on the leaves and everything. There's tons of flies. I put out a fly catcher bag, and I emptied that out 2 times, and it really smells. And then, but the flies are on this plant. And the plant's been there last year and had no problem. But this year, they're just on it, the leaves and everything. I don't know what they're eating off of there or what.
There are a number of insects that will actually utilize milkweed other than some monarch butterflies, as an example. But I am not sure. I guess I've never experienced or seen tons of flies on the milkweed. So I don't know. What do you Mark, has that ever been something you've experienced?
No, I could only speculate that maybe if some of the foliage was compromised or damaged, maybe some of that milky sap has some sort of a attractant to them, the scent. If this question were a couple months ago when milkweed was at peak bloom, I'd say there's a wide range of flies that are pollinators that might have an interest in the flower. But the fact that it's all over the leaves and such and hasn't done that previously, haven't had that problem, I'm really not sure.
Yeah, maybe somebody else has an idea about that. So stay listening, Donna. Appreciate your call. We'll turn to Lori in Appleton next. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my husband and I have raised garden beds, and we did cucumbers last year, and they turned out great. So we did cucumbers again from seeds this year, and I'm getting tons of cucumbers. But we also tried carrots for the first time, and I'm just curious. I feel as a beginner here, how can you tell when it's time to pull out the carrots? Because I've just sort of, out of curiosity, you know, kind of pulled one out, and they still look really teeny tiny. But I thought, okay, apart from just randomly pulling them out, how do you know when it's time to pull them?
And you've got them thinned really well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the thing about carrots is you can eat them at any stage. So, you know, sometimes people will pull them early for a younger carrot. Typically, following whatever the seed packet had on it in terms of days to not, maturity isn't the right word, but days to the more average time of cultivation or utilization, you know, mathematically you would get a feel for it. Now, if they're in looser soils, they'll extend quicker. If they're in tougher soils, they can be stubby, but, you know, again, still have great flavor. So I have to say it's kind of a crapshoot. And at home, our carrot rows, we'll just every now and then we'll tug up a couple like you've done, and we'll let we're taking these carrots up over the course of 4 to 6 weeks in a period of time. So,
and she's got a raised bed, so I can't imagine that the soil is all that compacted.
No, I bet it sounds like a good condition. So it sounds like they just have to go a little bit longer, but. Again, you can nibble on the ones you've already pulled out.
There you go, Lori. Thank you for calling. Bill in Hazelhurst. Hi.
Hi. How are we doing today?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
I have a hydrangea, a little tree with the white blossomy things on it. And it has some growths down below on the stump part of it, several of them coming up. And I was going to cut them off, but I'd like to cut them off and try to root them. Is that possible?
Great question. We've not tried to root hydrangeas, and maybe there's some listeners that have an opinion on it. But my guess is with the thing with hydrangeas is older stems are quite rigid and tend to be hollow, so they just won't root. So we would have to use the youngest growth, the earliest growth, a very short portion of those stems. Maybe with some rooting hormone and give it a whirl, but maybe some listeners have an idea on that because I've not done it personally.
Yeah, I haven't either. Along the hydrangea line, Chris in Decorah, Iowa, emailed to say she planted a hydrangea with white flowers in her landscape near another hydrangea. She planted it 2 years ago, and she gets lush foliage and green, but no blossoms on the new one. The other one blooms fine. Wondering what can she do?
Well, it could be the type of hydrangea. There's the macrophylla type hydrangeas have issues. Many of the older forms with a rough winter may lose their flower buds. They bloom on old growth, meaning the growth from the previous year, if it's compromised over the winter, just simply won't flower. If that's not the case, if it's a hydrangea that flowers on both old and new wood, deer browsing could be a consideration, although they likely would go for both. That's a tough call without knowing what specifically the hydrangeas are in terms of species.
Mary in New London, it's your turn now. Thanks for calling, Mary.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a pink daylily in my garden. It came with our house, so it's at least 30 years old, maybe even older. And I've always been curious and wanting to ask somebody about how it grows. It'll, in the spring, it'll send up this really lush foliage, long, slender green leaves coming out of a central root system. The leaves will look great for a few weeks. They turn brown and die, and then it blooms. And it is in full bloom right now. So all of these dead leaves surrounding these really tall, erect stalks of beautiful pink flowers. And I'm just wondering if that's a characteristic of some daylilies, if it's something that's because it's an older variety I don't know if I've ever seen any other lilies or heard of any that grow like that.
Hmm. Well, there's a good chance it's not a daylily. What you might have is what's called resurrection lily. So if you were to go out there today and you just see no leaves, just a green stalk up to a trumpet-shaped bloom that has kind of an iridescent light pink with sort of hints of violet on the interior, shaped like a daylily. These resurrection lilies send up their foliage in spring along with daffodils and tulips, and that foliage goes dormant. You don't see the plant at all until late July, August in the southern portion of the state, and those stalks come up. And so as we speak, what kind of clued me into your comments is we have about 2,000 of these resurrection lilies blooming right now, and they go through the exact same process that you described. So my guess is it's something different.
Yeah. That sounds pretty cool. Thanks, Mary. Appreciate the call. I was thinking about some daylilies that I bought at the Daylily Society's sale here three years back, I think now. And I just for fun, there were some giant ones, some tall growing ones. And these with bright yellow flowers, but they're over 6 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Tall.
There's some giant ones out there. Yeah.
They're really pretty.
Statuesque. Yes.
They're really pretty, and they're flowering right now. I really enjoy them. Kel in Sugar Camp, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm in the process of selling my parents' duplex. They've both passed on. And I've planted some beautiful hybrid lilacs. They're just gorgeous. And I want to take some cuttings and start them for myself. What is the best way to do that?
Well, there's a lot of research out there on how to do that, and it's a matter of timing and taking an appropriate length of stem. And to the comments earlier about hydrangea, just short, vigorous pieces of some of the youngest stems. But I would do a little more research on that because I've not done it personally, and I'd like to give you good advice because the timing, I think, becomes important.
There's some books out. I'm trying to think of the classic book on how to do that for any kind of plant. Like, it's not coming into my head right now. Maybe I'll think of it in a minute or two. But Cal, you need to do a little more research, I guess. Appreciate your call. Joan in Eau Claire. Hi.
Good morning. My question today is about lilies of the valley. I have quite a number of lilies of the valley in one of our rock gardens. And for the last three seasons, they've had no fragrance. They will bloom, but there's no fragrance. So I'm wondering if the pH needs some adjusting. And thank you for allowing me to speak.
Yeah.
That's a great question. I guess I've not heard of Lily of the Valleys losing their fragrance. And the fragrance is delightful, which is probably why you're concerned you haven't experienced it in 3 years. Of course, we all know the plant can run like the dickens, but it is beautiful. I'm not sure if it's a pH-related thing or it might be the springs we've had. Scent, of course, is a subjective sensation, but ultimately issues of humidity, wind currents, there's so many things that affect fragrance, but it sounds like you're not getting anything. And I really don't know the answer to that, to be honest.
Yeah. I'm sorry we can't help you on that one, Joan. Sharon in Green Lake County. Hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Oh, the question about starting hydrangeas. They're one of the easiest ones to start from softwood cuttings. And this is, I'm quoting, this is not my idea. There's an article in August 2018, Fine Gardening.
Fine Gardening.
Yes, and tells you exactly how to do it. And hydrangeas are listed as one of the easiest ones to propagate.
Well, good. Thank you so much for that call. Appreciate it. So Fine Gardening Magazine, the latest issue, I think.
Good magazine.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is a good magazine. Greg in Milwaukee emailed to ask if he could use cranberry plants as a ground cover under evergreen trees. The person at the cranberry growers both at the fair thought that he could. It seems like a stretch to me, but...
Yeah, I don't know cranberries real well, but my gut instinct would be that it would be an issue of moisture concerns.
Especially if they're growing under evergreen trees, you're probably looking at a fairly porous soil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that holding the water, giving them enough water might be a real real issue.
It'd be a stretch, I think, with the root competition.
Yeah. By the way, what's your email, or I'm sorry, not your email address, your website address?
People could certainly just Google up Rotary Gardens, but we're at www.rotarybotanicalgardens.org.
Yeah. Our guest today, it's always fun to talk with Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. Always fun to have him, and I hope you have a chance to visit there. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. How's your garden doing this year? Do you need some help? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we have open lines to get you on pretty quickly. So 1-800-642-1234. Bonnie in Waupaca emailed to say that in addition to all that's already been mentioned about overwintering rosemary, she has found that it's best to bring the plant in before you'd think it was time to do that, while your inside air is more like the outside air. If you wait until frost threatens, it's too late. And there's probably some sense. That makes some sense.
Well, rosemary in particular is very slow to show stress. So even if it's overwatered or it's been frozen, it still looks pretty good for a while. So I think that's a prudent advice.
And Pat in Luxembourg emailed to say he has 10 acres with a lot of Canada thistle on it. He started burning small patches last year. And this seems to have worked fairly well in keeping the thistles from coming back. But is he fooling himself? Will the rhizome survive and just spring up later?
Well, it'll keep coming back, but, you know, it's give it a good decade of the same treatment and you may win the battle. The idea with these plants respond with usually the first year they'll have increased vigor. They'll be like, okay, I'm coming back strong. But by repeated burning or cutting or attempted digging, the vigor over time is lessened. So you can win that battle as long as you never let them bloom, of course, and understand you still probably have a pretty good seed set in that area, still babies yet to germinate.
Let's take another call. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234. Julie in Eau Claire, thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Two problems. I've got on my hollyhocks leaves on the underside, and I've had them all summer. I still get hollyhock blooms, but they look like they're not cutworms like cabbage worms, but that's kind of how they hang on underneath, just dozens and dozens of little worms, and it's like they work from the bottom up, and they make like they eat the whole leaf like I got just like a web left. And then I also have stalk borers on all kinds of my flowers. How do I get rid of them without using chemicals if possible?
Ooh. Yeah, I don't think you can do it.
Yeah, that's a tough one. And hollyhocks are prone to so many problems. So the nice thing is they still bloom nicely, but by the time ours at Rotary Gardens or mine at home are peaking in terms of flowers, the leaves have already been compromised. They're skeletonized. So I don't have a real good answer how to deal with those problems. And maybe that's where some extension advice or that research angle would benefit you.
You might try a call or an email to the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. If you go to the Insect Diagnostic Lab, UW-Madison, if you just type that into the your search engine, you're going to be able to email the person who's in charge there, and they may well have some comment, but I don't know if there's going to be much hope there.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. Thanks, Julie, for calling. Louise and Nina, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. A colleague of mine gave me some of their rhubarb plant, and I put it in a raised bed, and it's been doing great. But I'm wondering, some people have said that I shouldn't try to harvest it this first season, that I should wait until the second year, but I've never done this before. So what are your thoughts?
My gut instinct is let it alone. Why don't you leave it till next year? Let it establish. You certainly could take a couple stalks if you like, but I think you want the plant to have as much leaf surface or photosynthesis, root establishment, tail end of the season, and then you'll be amazed at how vigorous it is next year.
Yeah, they're really a very vigorous plant, and that's probably pretty good advice from Mark there, Louise. Let's go to Rich in Wanakee. Rich, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Quick question. So I've had a vegetable garden for about 10 years, I think, 10 or 12 years, and I'm fairly meticulous on weeding it. I hand pull weeds, but I have a recurring one that comes back in force every year, and I've just grown to expect it. If there's like one main bloom of it, I call it splurge. It's got like a red vine. I guess it's actually edible, and little round oval shaped green leaves. And I'm wondering why I continue to get a huge outburst of that each year, and even though I weed it, it continues to come back. And I love your show, and I'll listen off the air or off the phone.
Trying to think of what the plant is.
Well, it could be purslane. The description of fleshy leaves and red stems. And there are a lot of weedy spurges out there, but this, if it has real glossy leaves and is a mat former, we have a horrible purslane problem at Rotary Gardens. And the issue for us is some of the seeds came in on some compost that was questionable. So always know where your compost is coming from, folks. It's not too hard to control manually, but we've had 10 years of it coming back. So the challenge with it is once it germinates, it takes less than a month for it to actually bloom and drop seed. So by the time you're noticing a good-sized plant of this purslane, assuming this is the problem, it's likely already dropped seed. It's dropped the next generation. So that's why it's notoriously hard to get rid of. I would encourage this gentleman to take a photo and send it, get it properly ID'd, and start there to make sure there might be some other control methods.
Yeah, I think that's very good advice, and you could send that. Could he send that into probably to his extension officer, as extension agent in his county, mm-hmm. and they can come up with an ID for him. Jan in Montello, it's your turn. Hi, Jan.
Oh, hi. It's Monticello, not Montello.
Okay.
I have a question. I have a small backyard, and I'm looking for a tree to put back there. The yard's not very deep. I'm considering the ivory silk Japanese lilac, and I wonder what Mr. Dwyer thinks of that tree.
Well, Japanese tree lilacs are beautiful. Now, ivory silk's a great selection. There's a lot of them. They're tough as nails, beautiful bark. You probably know the characteristics because you're interested in it. And, of course, the blooms are just a couple weeks later than standard lilacs. I would encourage you to look into, if you like tree lilacs, the thing about ivory silk is it's an intermittent bloomer. It does not bloom every year. It seems to bloom every other year or... it's very rare to have three sequential years in bloom, which is a huge concern. What we are leaning on now is a Peking lilac called China Snow. and it's beautiful exfoliating bark. I think it's far superior in not only bark coloration, but flowering, which is a real, that light creamy yellow. Also late blooming, we're talking early June here, but similar size and stature. Again, China Snow Peking Lilac, I think, superior to Ivory Silk, but they're both decent trees, but do a little research on China Snow. I think you'll like it.
I have a Japanese tree lilac right next to, growing almost into my front porch, and it smells so wonderful when they're in bloom. Oh my goodness, it's great to sit out on the porch in the evening and have a little cocktail and take in the aroma of the Japanese tree lilac. Jan, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Herb in Mauston next. Hi, Herb.
Good afternoon. I appreciate your show. And I have a suggestion or a recommendation that I need some advice on. Japanese beetles, obviously, we have them in the garden, and they're attacking the beans and the other plants we have there, some of them. And I just attended an IPM class at the university, and one of the discussion items we had were concerning trap plants that attract the bad bugs, and that way you can help alleviate them. My question or my idea would be to take some type of systemic pesticide and put that in the dirt for the trap plants and have the dirt in a pot so that it wouldn't contaminate the rest of your soil. And do that until they bloom, and then at that point, obviously, the pollinators might be able to get at that, and you would have to cut them down or whatever. Do you think that would work at all for taking care of the beetles?
Oh, man.
That's, I tell you what, that deserves some scientific study. I'm intrigued by that idea. I think that, and I understand your reasoning, the idea of attracting them outside your good stuff and having them nibble on the target plants and perish, keeping in mind that Japanese beetles go after the leaves, so it's not so much an issue. Not that the chemical wouldn't be in the blooms, but ultimately, that's intriguing.
Yeah, that's an interesting sounding approach. You're never going to get rid of all of them because there's great flyers. They can come in from a couple miles away. And if you're near a golf course, for example, you're going to always have Japanese beetles.
Yeah, and we are near a golf course, and that's one of our issues. But you know the joke about the Japanese beetle traps is put them in your neighbor's yard because you don't want to attract a huge amount in. But boy, that's interesting. I mean, I think the way it's laid out, it would attract the beetles and take care of a bunch of them. But the question is, would it be significant enough to benefit your garden?
Yeah, there you go. Give it a try, Herb, and let us know how it works. We'd love to hear about it. Thanks for calling. Eli in Menominee, your turn. Hi.
Hi. I have a little, pest problem, but I have little tiny beetles, and they're smaller than a flea, and they're, millions of them. And they seem to eat or drain the whole vegetation I had. All my vegetables are gone except for my cucumbers, zucchinis, and corn, which is more hardier. I'm not exactly sure what these little buggers are.
Boy, I'm not either. That's another one. Have you got photos of them?
Yeah, well, they're still there. I mean, I can take pictures, yes.
I would get as close as you can to get some close-up photos and send that to the insect diagnostic lab, because it's pretty hard to be able to figure out what they are from here. But at the insect diagnostic lab, PJ Leash, who is the head of that, might be able to identify it. And if you describe it, so take some photos and go online to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. You can post your photos there along with a comment. And PJ is pretty quick about getting back on things like that. So that's my recommendation. I think it's for us to try and figure it out. It's probably not useful. Let's put it that way. So it's the Insect Diagnostic Lab, UW-Madison. Get some close-up photos as you can and describe what you've got. And he's probably got some help for you. Thanks, Eli. Terry in Montfort, it's your turn. Hi, Terry.
Hello. I've got a miniature lilac bush that I want to transplant.
Okay.
So is that possible to do?
Is it? How long has it been in the ground?
3 years, 4 years maybe.
Yeah, and how big is it?
Well, I've been cutting it back.
Yeah.
So it's only shoulder height.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the timing is, I guess if you have a choice on the timing, I would recommend waiting about a month. And, it, of course, this depends on where you're located in the state. But, again, with warm fall soil temperatures, the important thing is getting this to a spot where it'll reestablish some roots prior to winter. So the short answer to your question is you absolutely can. Of course, you want to dig as wide of a hole as you can, get as much of the roots, move it quickly, water it in. We've had no trouble moving lilacs around, both in spring and late summer, early fall at the gardens. It's a better time of year now than it would be in spring because you may compromise the blooms.
Yeah, and make sure you keep it watered and growing well, and I'd water it well into the fall if you're not getting rain in particular. And let's see, Melissa in Wittenberg, your turn. Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, thanks for taking my call. About 5 years ago, I grew 5 green asparagus bulbs and 5 purple asparagus bulbs. And I got 5 of them, the green ones, to grow. And I know you're not supposed to pick them so they can reseed themselves, but now only 3 of them are growing, and I never got a chance to harvest any purple ones or green ones. I don't know how to make them grow better.
Well, a lot of the success with asparagus is with the soil preparation. So the fact that it's struggling may be related to the soil you have. In terms of knowledge of asparagus, that was, as a youth, that was the last thing left on my plate at home. So I don't feel it should be allowed to be eaten by anyone, to be honest. Of all the things, I'm putting my personal opinions into this, but I really don't know a lot about asparagus in terms of why that would be happening for you. But again, a soil test might lead you in the right direction on some improvements.
Yeah, that's if you haven't done a soil test, I'd probably get a soil test. And there is a publication on growing asparagus that is, I'm thinking it's available at the Learning Store, the UW Learning Store, learningstore.uwex.edu. And if you type in asparagus growing, you'll get a little publication, nice little publication that'll tell you what to do. And that coupled with a soil test could do the trick. Good luck, Melissa. Thank you for calling. Bill in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi.
Hi. Okay, the Chinese beetles.
Yeah, Japanese beetles.
Yes. I was going to tell you that my wife used to be a master gardener, but she has cancer, so she can't do it anymore. But you can use a Hudson sprayer or a spray bottle and use Murphy's oil soap and spray it on the leaves, and then bugs will get that in their belly, and that will suffocate them.
Murphy's oil soap.
I've not heard of that approach. I guess my only concern, I'm not disputing that it's effective. My only concern would be what its effect might be on other types of plant material or other beneficial insects, because insecticidal soaps of any sort affect a wide range of insects. So, again, it sounds like an effective use of that product, but I have no experience using it in a garden.
All right. There we go. Thanks, Bill. Appreciate the call. And let's take another call here. Linda in Merton, it's your turn. Hi, Linda.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. I have a lot of hydrangeas, all different kinds, and the ones that are not blooming are the common ones. They're either blue or pink, depending on the acidity in the oil in the soil. And I have not had any blooms for about the last three or four years. Lots of green foliage. Excuse me, green foliage, that part's beautiful, but absolutely no blooms on them.
Yeah, Linda, the challenge with those hydrangeas is years gone by, this, and I'm using some Latin here, but these macrophylla-type hydrangeas, those that would have the blue or pink blooms, depending on the acidity of the soil, as you mentioned, used to only be offered in a form where they would bloom on old wood. So in our colder climates, there'd be some compromised stems where the flower buds would be, you wouldn't have flowers normally the next year with a hard winter. Then they developed a wide range of these types of hydrangeas that should bloom on both old and new wood. I will say we've universally struggled with those that are promoted that will bloom both on old and new wood. So what I'm getting at is what you're experiencing, we've experienced with dozens and dozens of hydrangeas where we've seen the vigorous growth. We've seen no blooms whatsoever. The first year or two, once we've purchased them and put them in, they bloomed okay, and then they sort of faded to just being a foliage plant. There are some better varieties out on the market now, but my concern for you is that I can't tell you that those hydrangeas will ever bloom, to be honest, because for us, we gave it a good 8-9 years with some of these, and they just never came back to doing that.
Oh, so Linda, there you go. You might be in a situation where you might want to try something different or some different hydrangeas in that area.
There are some new varieties out there that are a little more hardy in terms of what I've described. So I'm not knocking those types of hydrangeas, but in colder portions of the state, they can be knocked back enough where I think there is a loss of vigor despite how they look, and they just will fall out of ever wanting to bloom. They put energy into leaves.
Thanks, Linda, for calling. And Suzanne in Stoughton will turn to you next. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So we have some Korean lilac and also bridal wreath, and then another type of shrub that I'm not sure what it is that has like little blue berries on it right now. And they are really overgrown. We've just moved into the house, and I'm wondering if it's an okay time to prune them and cut them back.
The challenge with deciding on when to cut woody plants back a lot of times is dictated on when they bloom and when they set their flower buds. So the concern about the lilac is it's already set flower buds for next year. So if you can put up with its size through the winter, you can enjoy the blooms next spring and then cut it back right after it blooms. Having said that, you're welcome to cut it back any time, but it might be at the expense of blooms this time of year. Bridal spireas, be wary. You can butcher them back, but it takes many years for them to regenerate. And they naturally have a vase shape and arcing form, so try not to compromise the form, but they do recover slowly. The blueberry one, I'm not sure of. It might be a viburnum. Those respond very well to pruning, but the issue with pruning now with any of these is you'll encourage active growth over the next couple of months that'll be compromised by frost. So if you're going to do any of this pruning that we've talked about later this year, I would wait until a couple of months from now and do it as we head into fall. But do consider the spring approach, certainly with the lilac.
And there you go, Suzanne. Thank you so much. Barb emailed to ask if there are bike trails in the Rotary Gardens. I don't think you have bike trails in the gardens, but
we do not have bike trails, but we are located right along a segment of the Ice Age Trail, so which goes through Janesville as well. So we do have a bike rack, so bring your bike down and go on in.
Yeah, that makes really good sense. Well, Mark, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Look forward to your next visit. And listen, if you haven't visited the Janesville Rotary Gardens, this would be a really good time to do it because everything is in full bloom right now. Mark Dwyer, he's Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk about a couple of new books on Monday, A Mystery Set in Lake Geneva, and John Goethe's new book on Milwaukee, A City Built on Water. That's at 11. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.